Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And we'll begin our program with some selections from the Daily Word. We still have not received the latest edition of Science of Mind, so I'm hoping by Christmas that we receive it and can share a lot of wonderful information with you. So, from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Giving. As I give generously, I bless others and myself. One of the best ways to experience my abundance is to share it. When I give generously, I place myself in the flow of abundance and truly know my prosperity. Giving is also a way to share my love. When I give a gift to someone close to me, my heart feels full as I see how my thoughtfulness has blessed them. Likewise, when I contribute to a cause I care about, I can imagine my gift blessing, serving, and helping untold others. God, Spirit, the universe, is at the heart of my giving impulses. Each time I give, I'm sharing the love and care of the divine. I'm also opening myself to a fuller experience of God, of Spirit, of the universe, and of myself as a divine being, heir to every good thing God is. Compassion. Compassion opens my heart and heals the world. When my heart is troubled by the awareness of the suffering of those close to me or throughout the world, it may be tempting to turn my attention away, to think about more pleasant things. But the call to care and the impulse to help is divinely inspired. This is compassion, wanting to make a difference and to make the world a better place. My compassionate acts improve and heal lives, including mine. By staying present to help someone through their pain, I am becoming braver to face my own. When I respond with warmth and sensitivity, Spirit is speaking through me. The love and care I feel inspired to share are of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Whether shared or received, compassion blesses everyone it touches. I've gone online to find a sample from the December issue of a daily guide to share with you. It's written by Reverend Dr. David Alexander. And here is a sample they're letting us share. Comparison kills creativity. There is room for you. Nobody can do it with your voice, with your experience, with your insight. Karen Walrond. I do not think we should make such a claim to divinity that we forget we are human, for our humanity proclaims the creativity of the divine. Ernest Holmes, Know Yourself, page 88.2. Unleash your creativity. Affirmation. Creativity flows through me like a vibrant river, turning everyday moments into extraordinary works of art. Diving deeply into my spirituality seems to unleash my creativity. The two go hand in hand. We often think of creativity as something only some people have, but the truth is we are all naturally creative beings. Creativity shows up in every moment, aspect, demonstration, manifestation, and thought. There's no escaping our inherent creativity. Since we already are incredibly creative, maximizing this power is more about raising our awareness of what already exists than it is about growth or potential. We always are creating and forever artists, yet creating art with intentionality and boldness requires courage. It's truly challenging to put ourselves out there and risk everything for our imagination and intention. This is the call of each day, to be more intentional and bolder in the lives we create, both individually and collectively. Every day I choose to see my creativity in everything I do, whether creating art, making breakfast, cleaning the house, handling paperwork, or spending time with friends. My whole life is a creative endeavor as a spiritual being, just as each person expresses their creativity in everything they do. Therefore, a conversation is simply a co-creative project. Embrace your creativity by recognizing the truth. You are a divine creative being. And again, the affirmation is, creativity flows through me like a vibrant river, turning everyday moments into extraordinary works of art. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, pursue the obstacle. Pursue the obstacle. It will set you free. When I came upon the mountain, I was in a hurry. I thought it would take too long to make my way around, so I set out to break a path through. Each rock and branch felt like a waste of time. If only the mountain weren't in the way. I cut my legs and arms as I rushed along. It grew harder to breathe, and I lost all sense of direction. Now I had to climb high enough to see. Once I broke the tree line, something in me had to see the top. Then I hurried my way up, and strangely, as I worked the climb, step after step, I kept rising, but felt as though I were going nowhere. Finally, I broke the clouds. I had never seen sun on top of clouds. I sat in a clearing on a cliff, the light on top of my head, like a cloud. Suddenly, reaching the top or getting beyond the mountain no longer seemed important. I liked it up here and felt that I could live on the mountain, but I had to return. I had to eat. I needed love. But now, when someone asks about breaking through what's in the way or being in a hurry, I look both ways and say, pursue the obstacle. It will set you free. This story invites us to honor each obstacle as something flowing on its own right in the universal stream, to see ourselves and the obstacle as two limbs of the same tree drifting in the same river, bumping into each other, and even blocking one another for a moment. Looking at obstacles this way, we are asked not to oppose what blocks us as something mounting its will against our own, for the obstacle will simply give our resistance back to us. We are being asked not to empower or perpetuate the life of the obstacle, but to step aside if we can with openness to the energy of the obstacle, much like the ancient art of Aikido, where instead of blocking a punch, you help the punch move past you. All the while, we are invited to question that in us, which insists that which is before us is an obstacle in the first place. It may not be so. It may be so. It may be something small that our history of struggle has enlarged into tragedy or bad luck. So if we can, we must focus on our relationship to the stream and not to the things being carried alongside us. If something appears to be blocking our way, we must try to understand what is moving it and what is moving us. If our movement in the world is still blocked, perhaps we are meant to be still. We must try not to damage ourselves unnecessarily by trying to force a movement to happen before its time. Identify the biggest obstacle in your life at present. What is it keeping you from? Describe the obstacle as a piece of nature that has its own history. Is it like a shell being broken by the surf, or a stone tumbling in a landslide, or like a small deer frightened in the middle of a busy road? How is what you want or need colliding with what it wants or needs? The work of love. Love courses through everything. Fakhruddin Iraqi. I recently learned that the first form of pencil was a ball of lead. Having discovered that lead, if scratched, would leave markings, people then wrestled with chunks of the stuff in an attempt to write. Through the work of many, the chunks were eventually shaped into a usable form that could fit the hand. The discovery became a tool. I am humbled to confess, after a lifetime of relationship, that love is no different. Be it a lover or a friend or a family member, the discovery of closeness appears in our life like a ball of lead, something that, if wrestled with, will leave markings by which we can understand each other. But this is only the beginning. The work of love is to shape the stuff of relationship into a tool that fits our hands. With each hardship faced, with each illness confronted, with each trespass looked at and owned, another piece of the chunk is whittled, and love begins to become a sacred tool. When truth is held in compassionate hands, the sharpness of love becomes clear and not hurtful. Bring to mind a significant relationship that you're struggling with. As you center yourself, pray that the love you share continues to find its form. As you enter your day, stay pliable and open to becoming a tool. And I just caught that in Science of Mind, the daily guides are written by Reverend Chris Alexander. And we return to Science of Mind for Reverend David Alexander's monthly column, Philosophy in Action. Oh, how I love this time of year. As fall turns to winter, we seek new sources of light and inspiration to guide us through. Life has been unfolding this way for humanity for centuries, across various cultures, traditions, and customs. If your heart has grown cynical of this over-commercialized version of the season, then I invite you to pause and consider the ways in which it's simply a metaphor for the universal longing of the human spirit to know itself again. Ernest Holmes, like many other mystics and teachers, was able to see this deeper truth and draw on the powerful imagery and creative storytelling presented in the Gospels as deeper invitations for our soul's illumination. Holmes reminds us that the creative law of the universe is activated by our word. As such, it is up to us to articulate the experiences we desire. Our word, he says, does not do anything on its own. It does not compel, but permits the law into action. Perhaps it's wise to slow down this season and consider just what we've permitted into our lives, into our consciousness, and what we've affirmed by subconscious agreement or passive allowance. It's safe to say many of us would find some unwanted ideas, thoughts, or constructs leering in the foreground of our mind. Yet these are not ideas we need to feel regret, shame, or anxiety about. Rather, Holmes reminds us that through the power of our creative thought and word, we can affirm the reality we desire. What we affirm will grow, and the law will eliminate what's not in alignment. It's no surprise that for centuries, at this time of year, humanity has gathered to affirm the light, to welcome the birth of new possibilities, and to rekindle hope, faith, peace, and love. Let's affirm together that peace is possible, new light is born, and with it all, the beauty and divinity we can conceive of is made flesh in you. Travel well. And I'm grateful that I am able to get online and get a few things from the current science of mind, even though the issue has not arrived. We return to the Daily Word for December's monthly affirmations. Inner peace. Divine peace is my path and my true nature. Guidance. I follow the star and respond to the light of divine wisdom. Healing. God is the flow of life within my body and being. Prosperity. I rejoice in abundant possibilities. World peace. The Christ born in me is a gift to the world. And from the same issue, an article by Reverend Todd Humphrey, On the Way to Someplace Better. I am fascinated by the ways people find meaning and comfort in the Christmas story. For some, it's the journey to Bethlehem. For others, it's the newborn child lying in a manger surrounded by animals. My mother, for instance, is deeply moved by an angel's edict to the shepherds, "Do not be afraid." I connect to the story through an aspect that is only implied, the innkeeper who turns away the travel-weary soon-to-be parents. My innkeeper experience taught me a valuable lesson about rejection and belonging. There's never a good time to lose a job, but the days leading up to Christmas may be the worst. 15 months prior, I had donated most of my belongings, packed up what was left, and set off to satisfy my dream of living in New York City, more than 500 miles from my southern home. Relocation was an attempt to free myself from the ennui and loneliness that I had known for most of my life. My inner voice demanded that something change, and I was sure this move would quiet that voice. I had headed north, determined to have a richer experience of life. Moving to New York was an attempt to satisfy both my teenage dream and to surrender to the call of spirit. Now that dream was about to be demolished. I was finishing up the final few things on my to-do list before leaving for a planned Christmas vacation when I was paged to the business office, unprepared for what I was about to hear. There's no easy way to say this, especially because everyone really enjoys working with you, but last night the board was reviewing our expenses and your position was eliminated. The operations manager apologetically added, "Today's your last day." I steeled myself, willing my voice and eyes to not add to the betrayal already gripping my lungs so tightly I could barely breathe. Every false idea of unworthiness roared in my mind, wrapping me in shame. The next day, I continued my plans to leave on Christmas vacation, but what was intended as a joyful, relaxing trip to Maine with friends was now tainted with embarrassment. My last conversation with my hosts had ended minutes before my firing. Sharing this news would needlessly overshadow holiday cheer, so I decided to keep it quiet. Alone in my host's house, draping the stair railing with garland, I finally felt the fullness of my reaction. I felt angry with myself for believing my life in New York had been a better fit for me than it had been. I blamed myself for being complacent in my discomfort. I even felt anger toward the people who had fired me, even though they told me the reason for my termination was budgetary. As I tied the last ribbon on the garland, my friend and her kids returned home. In an instant, sounds of excitement and holiday music filled my ears and softened my mood. I saw young, innocent eyes taking in the bright red bows. Their smiles reminded me of the Christmas decoration that had always made me smile as a child, the wooden nativity my mother placed in our living room every year. My present circumstance gave me a new perspective on that holy scene. In the Gospel of Luke, Mary gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. Tellingly, there's no mention of an innkeeper, nor is one represented in the nativity. I imagined the purpose of the innkeeper in the story was to set the scene that led to the humble manger. I saw myself in the Christmas story. There was no room for me at my job, just as there had been no room for Mary and Joseph at the inn. But the job I had lost and the circumstances of my termination were not central to my life story. They served the purpose of prompting me to move on, to take my place in a new story, one where I truly belonged. Of the Christmas story's many gifts, I especially value this one. We must be in the right place for the Christ to be born, and sometimes that means being told there's no room for us where we are. What we do with that news is up to us. Reverend Todd Humphrey is a minister at Crystal Coast Unity in Atlantic Beach, North Carolina. We turn now to the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication. Again, they have combined Unity Magazine with Spirituality and Health. And an article by Alan Hamilton, M.D., Trust the Larger Hope, Simple, Hard-Earned Lessons from a Lifetime of Brain Surgery. Hope is an odd emotion. Almost no aspect of human activity, endeavor, or aspiration can exist for long without it. It possesses the strange alchemy of serving as the power that drives us toward the light, as well as also being the light we seek. So it is both actor and agent. Even in our daily routines and schedules, hope fuels our ambitions in scores of minor episodes to take risks and prevail. I hope I can find a good parking spot. I hope I brought the file with me. I hope the pace lets up a little. We hope so much we hardly notice. But it is in the darkest, desperate moments that hope demonstrates its critical, stubborn luminescence. Viktor Frankl wrote in Man's Search for Meaning about his desperate struggle to survive in a Nazi concentration camp. Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. Hope lights that way. It gives us the resilience to endure. The U.S. Army Survival Manual, FM 21-76, describes hope as the desire to live despite seemingly insurmountable odds. Hope, it asserts, is the fundamental ingredient of resilience. The manual tells soldiers to think of hope as the ultimate weapon, and I think that's right. Hope is the ultimate weapon, for good. Hope unites communities and drives social change. It is the force of collective action and belief that makes a better world a possibility. Hope encourages empathy and compassion and helps us see potential in others. Hope may not be tangible, but it is always palpable. Hope is the essential ingredient that can spell the difference between giving up and giving in, or pressing on and standing up. Hope is the agent that shapes our goals and aspirations while simultaneously shielding them from despair. Hope is the workhorse of the best of civilization. Hope as a medical problem. One of the most potent forms of how one's will can warp reality is the placebo effect, which I first studied with Francis Moore, M.D., a scion of Harvard's surgical aristocracy and physician-in-chief at what is now Brigham and Women's Hospital. A true giant in the field, Moore defined modern surgical burn management and helped pioneer the world's first organ transplants. He was also an incredible, thoughtful, respectful innovator who shaped a generation of surgeons worldwide, and he warned me about the curse imposed by placebo. Once when we were about to examine a patient in one of his research protocols, he stopped me and told me not to oversell the research protocol, pointing out that this was a blinded study and we had no way of knowing whether the patient had received the experimental medication or a placebo. Speaking on behalf of scientific medical progress, he said, "There is no more damnable, mysterious, or confounding factor in all of medicine than the patient's own ardent desire to attend to a positive outcome. All who wish to contribute to medical research must contend with its undeniable power if they wish to have any chance of success." Moore explained that hope is a beautiful force for good for the individual patient. The problem, as he saw it, is that hope's effect is so operator-dependent, so unpredictable, and so variable that it was virtually impossible to quantify or calibrate, making hope a confounding and even vexing variable for researchers trying to discern whether or not a medical treatment works. Not coincidentally, the word placebo derives from the Latin verb placere, meaning to please. So the study of placebo started with this strange emphasis on a fake medicine provided to please rather than treat the patient. I sense that the denigration of placebos morphed into a more general worry about the potential for false hope, the notion that providing hope could somehow be wrong or unethical. With today's science, however, we better understand the power of hope. With brain imaging, for example, we can look at patients receiving placebo injections rather than real ones with opiates. If the patient believes they are receiving an opiate, their brain activity is very similar to someone who is receiving an actual injection. In other words, the patient is actually treated by the placebo in quantifiable ways. While placebos may be the bane of the pharmaceutical industry, they remind us how powerfully the mind can manifest what it yearns for. Hope is a unique kind of magic in medicine that we are only beginning to understand. Models of hope. Many complex models for looking at and defining hope now exist, but some of the earliest and simplest still serve us well. One is a definition proffered by Oxford's John P. Day, Ph.D., D.D., in his seminal essay, Hope. Day knew a thing or two about loss and hope. Despite being orphaned at 14, he attended Oxford and served in British intelligence throughout World War II. As the war was drawing to an end, Day was asked to document findings at an old munitions factory on the outskirts of Munich. He was one of the first soldiers to witness the horror that was the concentration camp at Dachau. In his philosophical thesis on hope, Day commented that hope could be reduced to two simple ingredients, probability and desire. He stated his definition in the same stark and streamlined fashion. Hope is a desire for an uncertain event. Many philosophers and social scientists have pointed out that hope is made of binding two elements together, yearning and uncertainty, need married to doubt. Day saw the stakes for hope could be high. Up to 50,000 lives perished at Dachau while praying to survive. Hope as a catalyst. Understanding that introducing hope as a catalyst for positive change in individuals and societies is critical. In the individual, research showed that introducing hope promotes the healing of conditions such as severe mental illness, depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Hope allows patients to maintain a positive outlook despite their health challenges and helps them improve their quality of life. Research studies have also demonstrated that therapeutic encounters built around hope can enhance empathic connections between clinicians and patients, making addressing patients' goals and the barriers to achieving them more accessible. Hope-based interventions also benefit vulnerable, underserved populations where mental illness may receive less attention. Such studies suggest that we must tread very carefully when we cross into territory governed by hope. Words, gestures, and body language are all part of how clinicians communicate with their patients. Study after study has shown that hope dramatically affects a patient's optimism, quality of life, support systems, activity level, pain perception, and more. A pledge to myself. When I was starting as a surgeon, I had a young patient with a malignant brain tumor who responded well to treatment. He had a tight-knit family, and I always knew when they showed up at the clinic because they would drive down from Flagstaff, Arizona, and I would see their RV in the parking lot the night before. We got to be very close over the years, and at one point, when his family was out of the exam room, he told me he would fight the tumor with every ounce of his strength. But he said if things ever really went south, he wanted me to be honest, to tell him it was time to go fly fishing. I saw no problem promising that and cared for him for several more years, but eventually the tumor recurred and I operated on it several times. Then, right before Thanksgiving, he came into the hospital in an emergency. The cancer was going to end his life in a matter of days if I didn't fix it. So I took him to the operating room and put in a shunt to relieve pressure on the brain, and he immediately brightened up. We were trying very hard to get him home for the holidays because I knew he didn't have much time left. His parents were out at the front desk picking up his prescriptions. I was alone with him for a few moments, so I looked at him and said, "You remember when you asked me to tell you when it was time to go fishing?" He nodded his head, and I said, "Well, it's time." I saw him turn sheet white and deflate like I'd stuck him with a pin. In the morning, I received a call from his mom. He passed away during the night. I had committed to telling him the truth. That was an honorable thing, and I kept my promise. But I also know he died because I inadvertently took away his hope. He saw me lose hope in him, and then he lost hope. He lost his life to my truth. What I learned from him is that no one has the right to take away another person's hope. Everyone is permitted to hold on to hope. On a broader scale, hope is the force for good behind movements for change, inspiring collective courage and action. Hope encourages empathy and compassion, a fundamental aspect of the human experience we should be cultivating. After losing that young man, I vowed I would never deny another human being's right to hope. I saw that each of us has the right to unfettered hope. I've learned that I can wait for a patient to tell me they've decided it's time to go fishing. I'll be there for them in the end, wherever they find it. We pause for a moment to remind you that you will listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We continue now with Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution, and we're in Chapter 5, The Sacred Pilgrims. He's been talking about agnostics, and we pick up with, in another gross generalization to the contemporary agnostic of the liberal bent in urban America, sacredness at its best might be applied to the feeling of awe and wonder toward the universe, that science has its own beauty and sacredness to be marveled and wondered at. What should be sanctified or honored should be the dignity of one's personal, racial, sexual, or gender identity. Universal human rights are sacred, perhaps, but rarely, if ever, would the concept be applied to a spiritual teacher or a shrine, a burial site, or metaphorical words in an old book. An atheist, for instance, might say that everything is equal in sanctity, a molecule, a human life, a star, a work of art, a tree. The 9/11 memorial feels like sacred, hallowed ground that both political left and right alike could be united in a shared embrace of. We all appreciate what happened there, the sacrifices that were made, the pain of loss, the needless devastation. That certainly is a place worthy of a pilgrimage. In his seminal work, The Sacred and the Profane, the religious philosopher Marcel Iliade writes of the difference between what is holy and what is earthly or profane. As I understand it, I tried to read the book. I really did. To him, a sacred space is defined by the divine meaning ascribed to it, and what is profane is simply the opposite, a space or a thing that has no sacredness attached, an object or place that has, to use his phrase, no cosmic sacrality. Think of the individual stones of Stonehenge. Large, yes. Impressive, for sure. But sacred? Not if they're lying on a beach or in a remote valley somewhere, not by themselves. But stand them on end and put them in a circle and correlate them to the equinox, and to this day the feeling of ancient power in the place cannot be denied. Nearby farming fields that are not ringed with impossibly placed stones would be considered profane and unhallowed in Iliad's philosophy. His work was revolutionary at the time because the idea of the sacred has been used as a cudgel for so many centuries by the Christian church. Sacred was only what was in and of the church, or in a church. Everything else was profane, sinful even. Sacred equaled heaven. Blasphemy equaled hell. As Iliad's work incorporated the teachings, writings, and faith systems of other world religions and allowed for their definitions of the sacred, he opened up a whole new way of seeing the word. Iliad's theory has a real quandary at its center, however. It implies that everything not specifically ascribed with meaning is profane. Really? Wouldn't that include all the rest of nature? What about a driveway or a bridge? An iceberg? Is a simple empty lot of land with a for sale sign on it profane? I think we need a new perspective and definition. I remember a few days after coming back home, sitting in my car on a Los Angeles freeway, my phone buzzing with alerts, and how I felt a longing for those precious hours in that consecrated place. I wondered if I would ever experience anything like that again. My perspective had shifted and my heart had been opened, but as I drove to my local coffee place or to an appointment, as I rolled calls while at a stoplight, as I dragged my garbage cans down the driveway on Tuesday evenings, I found a longing in my heart. I missed that experience of the holy that my family found in that garden in Israel. I kept thinking to myself, is nothing sacred? Is everything? If everything is sacred, can a 7-Eleven be sacred? A car wash? That area behind a strip mall where they keep the dumpsters? At first blush, I would probably answer no. The mundane is more likely profane. A place created only for short-term profit, like those ever-expanding shopping areas in the exurbs, filled with chain restaurants and auto parts stores, and those little speakers they hide in the bushes next to the parking spaces that pump out tired 80s hits. Places built without any thought of aesthetics or any nod to what's sacrosanct, only an offering to the shrine of the dollar. But we need to buy things, after all. There can't automatically and intrinsically be something unsacred about a place of business, can there? Consider the restaurant where my wife and I had our first date, Sea Thai in Seattle on 45th Street. It sits on an average row of businesses on a busy arterial. It was fully created for profit, but it also holds an incredibly special place in my heart, as our relationship took root there over shrimp puffs. I imagine everyone reading this can think of a list of unextraordinary places rendered holy due to some memorable event that occurred there. So is that it? Does a memory make something sacred? Was the shrine of Baha'u'llah simply holy because it allowed us to viscerally remember his life and legacy? Maybe it is worthwhile and fulfilling to take a pilgrimage to Lambeau Field, after all. I mean, there is joy there, exaltation, history, passion, community. Was I being elitist and judgmental when the cab driver brought up the idea? When I think about it from this perspective, I remember that I've had some truly religious experiences at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles, for instance, listening to music that transported, uplifted, and healed me. So is that, then, a sacred space, a shrine, worthy of a pilgrimage? Roughly 300 years ago, there was another pilgrim, Matsuo Basho, 1644 to 1694, the famous poet from Japan. Some consider him the greatest author of haiku in history. In his moving, sumptuous work, The Narrow Road to the Interior, sometimes called The Narrow Road to the Deep North, Basho wandered on foot hundreds of miles into various sacred temples and sites around medieval Japan in a state of spiritual and artistic contemplation. He famously said, "Real poetry is to lead a beautiful life. To live poetry is better than to write it." He also said, "The journey itself is my home." And his journey? He walked for dozens of miles every day on his poetic pilgrimage, journaling, noticing the specific details of the beauty of the natural world around him, the changes of the seasons and the sound of the breeze in the cottonwood trees. His day would end at a holy place, a crossing, a bridge, a harbor, a gravesite, a temple, or a monastery, and then Basho would begin his craft. He would compose a poem based on his travels, inspired by his personal life, wisdom, and experience, informed by his observations on the trail and in the forests, and devoted specifically to the sacred spot he was visiting on that particular day. He would then leave the poem behind him as an offering, a gift. For Basho, as with many Native Americans, there was no delineation between what was holy, what was of nature, what was art, and what was of religion. He wrote, "The temple bell stops, but I still hear the sound coming out of the flowers." Words like that could have easily been spoken by Black Elk or Luther Standing Bear. Nature, poetry, shrines, pilgrimages, God, art, spirituality, life, it's all part of the circle of the sacred and profound in the universe of Basho. Thich Nhat Hanh said, "In the sunlight of awareness, everything becomes sacred." So where is my circle of the sacred and profound? My daily challenge, our continuing challenge, is to find what is holy in our lives and recognize it. My family has a beautiful stone bench in the backyard surrounded by trees and flowers where we occasionally meditate and pray. That feels sacred to me. Perhaps it is awareness-opening meditation itself that is a gateway to the sacred, the eternal. When I was at Baji, in the sunlight of awareness of that holy space, that blessed trip, I felt the differences between me and others disappear. Their otherness melted away as we visitors joined together in this act of pilgrimage. That may be the heart of holiness itself, the melting away of the illusion of separateness. So, dear reader, I ask you this. What makes up your circle of the sacred? I won't ask you for anything else. I mean, you've already bought my book. But please take 5 minutes to consider, in a moment of personal reflection, these five questions for yourself. What is holy to you personally? Maybe it's a religious tome, but it doesn't have to be a thing. A garden, but it doesn't need to be a place. A family dinner, maybe? Where does sacredness live? In a poem or prayer? Sunday church services? Any group of people united in service to make the world a better place? The night sky, a remote forest or beach or mountain? What should be sacred to all of humanity? Love, science, families, whatever their form, humanity, that strange family of 8 billion people inhabiting the same ball of mud in outer space? Stars, places of worship, the atmosphere? What is most definitely not sacred? Is it the profane, the mundane, or just any place or anything that is filled with the worst humanity has to offer, hate, baseness, or selfish behavior? The seven deadly sins like greed and lust and rage? Are the jabbering talking heads and outraged personalities of opinion news and social media worthy of any reverence? What have we lost by not having more sacredness in our lives? Our ability to pause and be still? our sense of awe for the things we can't explain, a connection to our souls, to nature, to each other? Would we have deeper and more meaningful thoughts, conversation, and communities if we centered our attention around and toward the holy? My hope here is to spark only one action in your mind and heart, a moment of pause. Reflect on the questions above. Reflect on what you do or don't find sacred. Perhaps the goal is to find what you consider sublime and then slowly, ever so slowly, increase it. Increase day by day what is sacred to you. Reflect on what could be gained by finding ever more pockets of the divine in your daily life. Share your findings with someone close to you, or even better, someone you're not close to. Going back to the cultural divide around the concept, what if it's all true? What if it's all sacred? What if it's not an either-or? Jesus taught love. That's most certainly sacred. Science teaches interconnectedness, which is, for all practical purposes, the same thing as love. Families, whatever their form, are sacred. Humanity, after all, is itself a kind of family, 8 billion strong, inhabiting the same ball of mud in outer space. Stars are sacred, as are churches and trees and babies in utero. And so are human rights and the symbol of the cross and how we identify and define our individuality. What if what brought us all together, all us people in contemporary America, was a focus on the light in our lives, things that healed wounds and gave our divided, confused, distracted, and outraged world some solace and unity? What if sacredness, rather than being relegated to a place or a thing, was a condition of holding divine light, an internal condition of communion? As when a flower turns toward the sun or an owl toward the moon, can the sacred live in the sharp intake of breath caused by the beauty of a sunset, in the ripple of the words, "I love you," said to a spouse or child or parent or friend or pet? The recognition of the blessed, radiant nature of each and every human being, sanctified in grace? At the end of the day, I really don't have any answers. Maybe Basho does. I wish he were around to ask. I picture Basho walking through our modern world in his medieval robes, demonstrating to us all how to live poetry. Maybe that's what makes a pilgrimage at the end of the day, living in poetry. I imagine Basho journeying to the shrine at Baji, where he removes his sandals and bows his head in reverence as he picks up a prayer book. He backs out of the sacred space and, hand in hand with Baha'u'llah, walks along the freeway toward the middle west of the United States. Captain James T. Kirk and Kwai Chang Kane join them as they walk. Together they cross the plains of the Dakotas, where they meet up with Luther, Standing Bear, and Black Elk, and eventually that cab driver from the Wisconsin airport. Basho walks with all of them, these sacred pilgrims. He walks with every one of us, secular and spiritual, city folk and country folk, pilgrims all, through the streets of Green Bay to the iron gates of the legendary Lambeau Field itself, leaving behind poetry and prayers, making everything sacred in his wake. Chapter 6, Religion, Schmeligion. On my podcast, Metaphysical Milkshake, which I do with the writer, scholar, and general roustabout Riza Aslan, we ask each and every guest, what's one eye-opening experience that everyone should have? I thought I'd ask myself the same question right here on these pages, as I've had so many over my many ungainly years on this blue planet. Holding my son at dawn, only minutes old, after he and his mother almost died in a horrific childbirth in the hallway of a crappy Van Nuys, California hospital. Seeing Ingmar Bergman's mind-blowing 3.5 hours-long Swedish-language production of Hamlet, starring Peter Stormare. Getting married as bagpipes laid on the banks of a river under what was left of Mount St. Helens, my soon-to-be wife Holiday being rowed down the river in a raft filled with flowers. Oh, my. Witnessing from a fishing boat the majestic and terrifying calving of a glacier in remote Greenland with no one else around for hundreds of miles. Erupting in joy along with my fellow castmates when the TV show I was on won the Emmy mere months after it was almost canceled repeatedly. Hint, it was The Office. Swimming next to dolphins and sea turtles with my wife and son off the coast of Hawaii. The list goes on and on. But my final answer? Jerusalem, the old city, a historical tour. Let the history and sacred beauty of this glorious and terrifying city sink in as you explore it, hopefully with an experienced guide. Do it before you die, please. This is the one eye-opening experience I believe every person should have. My wife, Holiday, and I visited many years ago and were blessed with this incredible tour guide named Bruce. He was much more than a mere tour guide. He's a nonstop monologuist, historian, comedian, philosopher, immigrant to Israel from suburban Boston, big authority on all things political and historical in the Muddle East, as he insisted on calling it. He opened my eyes and introduced me to a whole new way of seeing the world and to some of the very best hummus, falafel, and hava I have ever tasted. Here's why you should take this trip. In Jerusalem, within an area of a couple kilometers, there are three of the most holy sites in the world. These sites are all centered around what is known as the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif to Muslims. It cannot be stressed enough how ancient, powerful, and revered these three locations are in the hearts of Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Millions, perhaps billions, would be willing to sacrifice their lives for these edifices. There is no greater political, social, and religious potential flashpoint for violence in the world. And when one realizes that these sacred structures are all a couple of frisbee golf throws away from one another, it is a stupefyingly enlightening revelation. The aforementioned interconnected sites on or near the Temple Mount are as follows. The Wailing Wall, or Western Wall, or Hakotel, which means wall in Hebrew. The Foundation Stone, which lies inside the Dome of the Rock, a.k.a. the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which marks the location where Jesus was both crucified and 3 days later resurrected. Disclaimer, I will do my very best to describe these structures and their tremendous significance. Many actual historians and theologians who are much more deeply versed in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity will probably have a very different take on the importance of these sacred sites and might vehemently disagree with my feeble layman's assessment. There are a lot of passionately differing opinions on everything concerning the Holy Land. True story. There's even a deathly serious contention between Jews and Arabs over who invented hummus. So don't judge. I'm just a stupid actor. At the center of the Temple Mount is the Western Wall, or Wailing Wall. This is one of the most sacred spots in Judaism. You've seen it in the news and in books, magazines, and movies. Little prayers written on tiny pieces of paper are frequently pushed into the cracks of its edifice by throngs of yarmulke-wearing visitors. Orthodox Jews in black suits gather there reading from the Torah. It's sacred for a whole bunch of reasons. First off, it is a place of intense prayers of gratitude and mourning and the begging of divine mercy. The silent prayer, or Amidah, is traditionally said while facing toward the wall, no matter where a Jewish believer might be in the world. Most importantly, it is the only existing remnant of the walls of the Second Temple built on the foundation stones of the First Temple. You see, once upon a time, wise King Solomon built a most holy temple for the Jewish tribes, only to have it destroyed by the Babylonians a few hundred years later. That was the First Temple, the Temple of Solomon, created about 1000 BC. A few decades after that, following the Babylonian captivity, when the temple was destroyed and a large portion of the population of the Jewish nation had been taken as slaves to Babylonia, the Second Temple was built. It had a lot of ups and downs, as so many ancient temples do. King Herod of biblical fame did a huge expansion of it around 200 BC, only to have the entire thing flattened by the Romans in AD 70. Interestingly enough, as we're about to find out, this entire Temple Mount is ultimately one gigantic celebration of monotheism. But when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, they built their new city of Aelia Capitolina right on top of it as a celebration of the god-man Caesar, Hadrian, the chief Roman god Jupiter, and many other gods in their pantheon. In other words, polytheism. But guess who's laughing now? Rome? Answer, God. The Western Wall is a segment of the wall from the period when Herod had expanded it. It is mysterious and sacred for countless reasons, religious, historical, and cultural, but notably because of its proximity to the foundation stone, or noble rock, as it's referred to in Islam. Which leads me to the next mind-blowingly sacred building, only 50 meters away, that surrounds said stone, the Dome of the Rock. This incredible architectural achievement was built in AD 690 by the head of the Muslim faith at the time, the Caliphate, on the site where the Second Temple once stood and directly over the previously mentioned foundation stone. This stone is totally rad. First off, it was supposedly where God created the world, so there's that. And as if that wasn't enough, it's supposedly also where he created the very first man, Adam. In the Baha'i belief system, Adam was not the first actual human being, but rather the first recorded divine messenger, prophet, or manifestation of God. Cain and Abel had a picnic lunch on that rock, and I'm not making this up. The Ark of the Covenant apparently once rested on it. It was also the very stone where Abraham, the world's first monotheist, was about to sacrifice his son. Isaac in the Hebrew Bible, Ishmael in the Muslim tradition, before God jumped in and said, "Gotcha! Just wanted to make sure you'd do anything I asked, sucka." Beneath this stone is also the Cave of Souls, a place where souls await judgment on Judgment Day, according to Muslims. The space is referred to in Judaism as the Axis Mundi, the Holy of Holies, where heaven and earth converge. I mean, a rock really doesn't get more sacred than this particular rock. On our trip, we didn't get to see the actual stone, as the entrance to the Dome of the Rock was off-limits due to political unrest in Israel. But just being near it, one of the most profound places in all of human history, was enough to give me epic tingles. Feel free to take a moment to find an online photo of this fairly ordinary yet monumental flat stone around which this gorgeous, ornate, golden, rainbow-tiled mosque was built. To Muslims, this location is the third most holy spot in the world. It is the site of the Prophet Muhammad's mystical midnight journey, where he traveled to Jerusalem on the back of the winged steed Barak, and then ascended to the seven heavens, aided by the angel Gabriel, and met with all the previous prophets of the world's major religions, Adam, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, etc., and received instructions from Allah about prayer. But back to the Temple Mount. As if what I just described wasn't enough of a plethora of sacred and holy buildings, walls, rocks, and whatnot, a mere half a kilometer away sits the imposing Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So much happened to Jesus within this awe-inspiring edifice, it's hard to keep track. Let's summarize. First, the last four stations of the cross occurred within the boundaries of the church proper. Calvary, the hill where Jesus was crucified, is right there in the corner as well. On the lower levels, there's a cave that was discovered by the Emperor Constantine's mother, Helena, that all were sure was Jesus' original tomb. As we know from Sunday school and marquees in front of evangelical churches, Jesus, after 3 days, went up to heaven to be with his Father. That happened in this space as well. Like I said, quite a busy site on or about the year A.D. 33. Constantine ordered the giant temple to Jupiter that his Roman forefathers had built on the sacred ground to be torn down and a grand church to be built in A.D. 326. Within the church, the true cross on which Jesus was crucified was supposedly displayed for many hundreds of years. Here's what's fascinating about this particular church. It is cooperatively shared by multiple branches of Christianity. Remember, there are more than 45,000 denominations of what is often thought of as a three-headed church, Catholic, Protestant, and Eastern Orthodox. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is administered by the Greek Orthodox Church, the Armenian Apostolic Church, the oldest in the world, and the Roman Catholic Church, as well as, though to a lesser degree, the Coptics, Ethiopians, and Syrian Catholics. There's even a literal schedule hanging on the wall about who gets to control or be in certain parts of the church at certain times. When I was there, the main floor of the building was shifting control from one of those towering, hat-wearing denominations to another. One group of rogue priests was marching out and another marching in. They were swinging chained incense around in their smoky thurbles. Yes, that's a word. As they are wont to do, chanting and marching as they came and went, seeding and gaining authority over a small section of the real estate of the floor of the church. Suddenly I noticed something that truly struck me. They were swinging their chained metal censers around, smoke pouring out of the holes in a remarkably aggressive manner, almost toward the members of the other church as they passed them. Their loud chanting was a bit hostile as well. The negative energy in the most holy church of all, Christianity, was palpable. So I did what any God-fearing, tech-savvy tourist would do. I pulled out my phone and did a deep Google dive right there under the sacred pillars and arches. What I discovered was that serious fights break out between the various factions all the time. Here's a small taste from the always reliable Wikipedia. On a hot summer day in 2002, a Coptic monk moved his chair from its agreed spot into the shade. This was interpreted as a hostile move by the Ethiopians, and 11 were hospitalized after the resulting fracas. In another incident in 2004, during Orthodox celebrations of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross, a door to the Franciscan chapel was left open. This was taken as a sign of disrespect by the Orthodox, and a fistfight broke out. Some people were arrested, but no one was seriously injured. On Palm Sunday in April 2008, a brawl broke out when a Greek monk was ejected from the building by a rival faction. Police were called to the scene but were also attacked by the enraged brawlers. On Sunday, 9 November 2008, a clash erupted between Armenian and Greek monks during celebration for the Feast of the Cross. One only has to do an online search of monks brawling, fighting, church, Holy Sepulcher, to be met with dozens of incredibly disturbing photographs of various priests going at it, UFC style, under the roof of the sacred edifice that surrounds where Jesus Christ ascended to heaven. But as wild as that may be, by far the most interesting detail of the Church of the Holy Sepulcher is how the place is locked up at night. As we were getting ready to leave our tour, my awesomely curious wife, Holiday, saw a little old man in a suit and tie sitting nobly on a bench near the ancient front doors, holding an enormous key. So, of course, we had to take pictures with him. After some conversation with him and our tour guide, Bruce, we came to understand that his family, the Drudays, Muslims all, have been holders of the key to this church for over 800 years, passing through the generations from father to son. Apparently, in the year 1192, after the famous Muslim leader Salah ad-Din recaptured the Holy Land from the Crusaders, he appointed a Muslim family to be the ones with ultimate access to Christianity's most holy site. That's right. And probably the ultimate metaphor of multi-faith interdependence on this volatile chunk of land, Muslims, besides having a mosque that sits on the most holy place in Judaism, hold the key to the most holy Christian location in the world, all under the jurisdiction of a country governed by the Jews. And thank Allah they do, because if any of the Christian clergy had ownership of it, they would probably all be clobbering each other over the head to get it, like some kind of interdenominational, silly hat-wearing, incense-swinging squid game. Why am I bringing all this up? Well, yes, it is an eye-opening experience that I think every human should have, but there's more. So let me back up a little bit. We live in a fractured world. A large portion of the population seems to live in accordance with rigid religious beliefs they have inherited from ancestors, culture, and family. Sometimes these beliefs feel like a blind, inflexible adherence to a conservative series of ancient doctrines that have not been personally explored and that have little relevance in the modern world. When I see certain Christians denouncing vaccines and condemning gays to hell, some Hindu nationalists promoting violence against women and girls, a group of Muslims praising the killing of innocent civilians as acts of holy heroism, or a community of Jews praising Elohim as they bulldoze Palestinian settlements, I frequently wish there were no religions remaining on our planet. As so many others, I'm not alone in this. This secular portion of the world sees religion as a vestige of an ancient series of outdated, violence-inducing superstitions. The atheist or non-religious 15% of the world's population, almost 1 billion people, adamantly believes that humanity, finally freed from its religious dogmas, will embrace the science, common sense, agreed-upon human rights, and collective ethics that will ultimately lead to the flourishing of humans as a species. Never mind that time and time again over the last century, non-religious-based societies have failed to bring said flourishing to an even greater degree than religious attempts. The most egregious examples include Stalin in the Soviet Union, Pol Pot in Cambodia, Imperial Japan, Mao's Cultural Revolution in China, and even, I'm loath to mention it, Nazi Germany. Dozens of attempts to build secular man-made societies on a basis of nationalism, militarism, racial supremacy, and/or materialist ideals have crashed and burned and killed millions. Now, I understand that these examples are extreme. There are billions of peace-loving religious folks and secular folks now and throughout history who want nothing to do with extremist violence. There are obviously dozens of predominantly secular atheist cultures that, by most accounts, are working amazingly well. Here's looking at you, Scandinavia. And there are also many countries that are religiously balanced in culture and outlook that, for the most part, seem to be generally flourishing, such as Thailand, Ghana, Turkey, and a rapidly improving Colombia. Looking at all this chaos, conflict, and confusion, it all boils down to one enormous question that burns to your mind as you witness the bizarre and beautiful happenings at the Temple Mount. Is religion even worth it? As we dig into that question, we must first take a good look around at what we have and what is effective in terms of religion. If you're tempted to abandon religion entirely, it's worth first asking, well, what religion is currently in place in contemporary America and by proxy in the majority of the Western world? What religion is actually working? How do we define religion in today's society? What do people truly worship? What is the religion we want to disband or jettison? The scholar and historian Joseph Campbell would often speak of how we know the priorities of a culture by its tallest buildings. For centuries, it was churches and mosques whose peaks would rise above a village or town. Then it was the edifices and towers of government that stood tallest, the town halls, the presidential palaces, the official buildings of various parliaments. And finally, over the last century, it has been the skyscrapers and headquarters of corporations that have created the staggering skylines of the world's greatest cities. These temples to capitalism tower over the government buildings and churches of the 18th and 19th centuries, signaling the ascendance of businesses, brands, and the commerce of things and stuff as the focal point of adoration and human accomplishment. Is it the dazzle of the church-like spire of the Chrysler Building that America turns to in modern worship? Or what the building stands for? Success, optimism, a can-do attitude, and of course, profit. Lots and lots of profit. Continuing along that line of thinking, it's the figures who fill the front pages of magazines and are followed by tens of millions on social media who are worshipped by contemporary society. Our gods, then, would appear to be Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Kim Kardashian, Ronaldo, and Beyoncé. Actors, singers, sports figures, models, entrepreneurs, politicians, reality TV stars, and those renowned for their penchant for self-promotion. Now, I'm certain that celebrities have existed in every culture that has ever been throughout the entirety of human history. Artists, warriors, generals, gladiators, writers, sportsmen, politicians, as well as great and legendary beauties. We human beings love to obsess over the famous and infamous. Always have, always will. But were they revered and scrutinized in the past as they are in 2023 with the same rapturous, feverish intensity? We witness through social media every red carpet outfit, every gaffe, every vacation, every romance, every TikTok or Instagram post by contemporary celebrities is combed over, discussed, and explored ad nauseum in every possible medium. They fill our screens, our billboards, our imaginations, our mythology, and the general populace eats these stories up as swiftly as the press continues to regurgitate them. And this is, again, an interesting place to stop, but we will continue again in the coming weeks. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I very much look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.